Since 9/11, the Tunnel to Towers Foundation has been committed to improving the lives of America's veterans, first responders, and their families. For over 20 years, the foundation has helped America keep its solemn promise to never forget. Tunnel to Towers provides mortgage-free homes to Gold Star families and the families of fallen first responders with young children, and builds specially adapted smart homes for catastrophically injured veterans, as well as work to eradicate veteran homelessness. David Marshall served in the Army during World War II and fought in the Battle of the Bulge. He's never forgotten the sacrifices of his comrades in arms, nor the efforts of first responders on 9/11 and in the days and months that followed. He is a loyal and proud foundation donor. Tunnel to Towers is committed to supporting veterans, first responders, and their families, and so many of them need your help. Join the foundation on its mission to do good and never forget. Donate $11 a month to Tunnel to Towers at t2t.org. That's T, the number 2T.org.
Hey, it's Will Friedle.
And Sabrina Bryan.
And we're the hosts of the new podcast, Magical Rewind.
You may know us from some of your favorite childhood TV movies, like My Date with the President's Daughter.
And the Cheetah Girls movies.
Together, we're sitting down to watch all the movies you grew up with and chat with some of your favorite stars and crew that made these iconic movies happen.
So kick back, grab your popcorn, and join us. Listen to Magical Rewind on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
So I know you've got a lot going on, but remember, I'm here for you. So bother me when no one's listening, because I will. Bother me when it feels like it won't get better, because it can. Bother me because you're never a bother. Whether it's a low point or a crisis, get help for yourself or a friend. Learn more at neverabother.org or call or text 988, available 24/7.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Either you're with us or you're with the terrorists.
If you've got health care already, then you can keep your plan if you are satisfied with it.
Donald Trump is not going to be president of the United States. Take it to the bank.
Together, we will make America great again.
We shall never surrender.
Never surrender.
It's what you've been waiting for all day. Buck Sexton with America Now. Join the conversation. Call Buck toll-free at 844-900-BUCK. That's 844-900-2825. The future of talk radio. Buck Sexton.
Buck Sexton here with you, team. Thank you so much for joining. An honor, a privilege, and a pleasure, as always, to have you with me here in the Freedom Hut. If you want to call in, 844-900-BUCK, 844-900-2825. Lines will be open here, or are open. So a bunch of different topics to get to today. I don't feel the need to jump right in to the biggest news story of the day, because there's a lot of different news stories that I am going to want to get into with you. And we will give you some updates on Hurricane Irma aftermath. We will certainly talk about, we'll talk about North Korea and the UN Security Council sanctions on it in a national security buck brief in hour two today. And we'll have some guests joining to talk about Hillary Clinton's book tour, as well as the politics of ESPN and politics in general. And in the final hour, I will have to give you my thoughts on an individual who has gone viral for a very amusing national TV debut. You will want to stick around for that. That is coming up in the third hour of the show. And the Apple iPhone X, right? The iPhone X, which will cost $999. I'm not a tech guy. I'm not going to pretend that I'm somebody who can shed a lot of light on Apple products, nor am I someone who stands in line and gets all that excited about them, although I use all these things. If someone took my iPhone away long enough, I think I'd go into a form of withdrawal.
But I will be talking to you a bit about that. The 8S and the X, is that what's out? The 8S and the X are all coming out. So there's that. But first, politics. Let's talk about what's going on in the world of all things D.C. right now, because you've got a couple of threads coming together. For one, you have Hillary Clinton out there making the case openly during her What Happened tour that there was Russia collusion and that they tried to help Trump, and they did help Trump, and without providing any further evidence from what we already know, she's just out there saying this stuff. She told USA Today, quote, there certainly was communication and there certainly was an understanding of some sort, because there's no doubt in my mind Putin wanted me to lose and wanted Trump to win. And there's no doubt in my mind that there are a tangle of financial relationships between Trump and his operation with Russian money. And there's no doubt in my mind, she repeats it three times, that the Trump campaign and other associates have worked really hard to hide their connections with Russians, end quote. This is as irresponsible as I think you're going to see a major political figure, or perhaps former political figure in this country, get when it comes to her rhetoric. I mean, this is so far beyond what would be expected of somebody who, at least if you listen to the media, is a great example of a politician who does things the right way, who speaks about the issues the right way, who has integrity and, well, I know, Hillary integrity. You're like, and I agree. I walked into that one that just hit me in the face like a 2x4. Yes, Hillary and integrity do not go in the same sentence, but she's saying that the president is guilty of, let's just, you know what the real charge is? It's collusion isn't a crime unless you're colluding in a price-fixing scheme. There actually are statutes where you can collude and it's criminal, but it has to do with price-fixing, I think, and has nothing to do with a international conspiracy to throw an election. But, you know, I just think that it would be better, it would be more honest if Hillary would say that she's accusing Trump of disloyalty to the country. But that feels strange for Democrats to say it in such a plain and straightforward fashion, because they usually hold up disloyalty, whether it's Chelsea Manning or Edward Snowden or any number of people, as sometimes worthy of a claim, right? So disloyalty would be too straightforward a description of what she's accusing Trump of. And she has no further evidence of this. And I think it also goes to why so many are still befuddled in the media. How is it possible that given the all-out assault on Trump that we have been engaged in, that it hasn't derailed the administration yet? It hasn't really worked. And it's because we see people like Hillary Clinton out there. Every time Hillary opens her mouth, hello! No, but every time Hillary is out there making a case about how Donald Trump is disloyal, treasonous, a bad guy, worked with the Russians to steal the election, whatever it may be, it's a reminder that the same people who go on TV or get on the, well, not as much on the radio, thankfully, but who go on TV or write for major newspapers or websites telling you that you never should have voted for Trump, that it's an embarrassment, that you should have voted for Hillary because she's a much more mature, responsible option for this country. You just say to yourself, well, you're discrediting. You're discrediting everything else that you say after this is going to be discredited, because if you're hanging your hat on the thesis that Hillary is so much better than Donald Trump, and that Hillary is such a great person and would have been so good for this country, a lot of people just don't want to hear it. They just don't want to hear it, because there is a blindness among so many on the left, not just to Hillary's imperfections, but to her deep, deep moral failings, and also political and ethical failings, too. So this, I think, is why right now you're seeing that the Democrats aren't really sure of what the assault on Trump needs to be, of how they're supposed to. They've tried so much, right? Trump was a treason, and then Trump was a racist, and now he's a white supremacist, and then he's, But then he made this deal with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. He's talking about tax reform. He's saying that Republicans should work with Democrats to get this done. And there are just a lot of different pathways that Trump is opening up that don't fall in line with the narrative that the left has been saying, which is that Trump is this madman, this he's like the Conan the Barbarian of politicians. He's just coming in and wants to hear the lamentations of the women. I mean, you know, for those of you who know Conan the Barbarian, it's a famous line. My Conan impression needs some work. But nonetheless, this is what we're looking at right now. An administration that doesn't fit in to any of the predetermined narratives that were offered or rather jammed down. They weren't really offered, that have been slammed in our faces time and time again since the very beginning. And we just see that they keep on being wrong, or they keep on abandoning the initial series of allegations for another series of allegations. It's just anything to defame and destroy Trump. And it's not on the policy substance. I mean, I'll get to the Medicare for All push going on right now among Democrats, which is, look, it would be great. I think it's so fascinating. It would be a great thing if the country could afford to pay for great health insurance for everybody. And if there are a way to do this without destroying our capitalist system in the long run, and enormous taxation, tremendous restraints on economic growth, and truly, I mean, we already have a confiscatory tax system that is not progressive, I should add, not progressive in the way that it really would be if it were about redistributing from the rich, because it really largely punishes those who are trying to become wealthy because it taxes earnings. But I wish that we could have everyone getting free, or not free, but everyone having their health care paid for by the government. But I know that there's so many downsides. I also wish that I could go home and eat like 4 chocolate bars every day. And I mean, I'm not saying I've never done this, and it wouldn't have any effect on my health, my well-being, or my weight. But that's just not the case either. So Democrats haven't yet figured out what the message is going to be, because the "we hate Trump" stuff, which comes from Hillary, comes from others, that's not going to be sufficient. And I think you're now seeing a turn to, okay, fine, if it's going to be Medicare for all, then we might as well start pushing that right now. By the way, Sarah Huckabee Sanders referred to Hillary Clinton's book as sad.
Whether or not he's going to read Hillary Clinton's book, I am not sure, but I would think that he's pretty well versed on what happened, and I think it's pretty clear to all of America. I think it's sad that after Hillary Clinton ran one of the most negative campaigns in history and lost, and the last chapter of her public life is going to be now defined by propping up book sales with false and reckless attacks, and I think that that's a sad way for her to continue this work.
I think that's completely fair. They are false and reckless attacks. To say that the sitting president worked with a foreign power against the interests of the American people to cheat in an election is a mind-blowing accusation. And this is from Hillary Clinton. This isn't even just from all the pretend journalists and the fake news who are saying that they are objective, they have no bias, they have no partisan affiliation. This is from someone who is, based on what we are told all the time, supposed to know better. This is from someone who's supposed to be better than that. But it's Hillary Clinton. She's not better than that. She fights as dirty as any person could ever hope to fight when it comes to politics. There's no question about it. Speaking about the political fight, there was some interesting back and forth today over the future of former FBI Director James Comey, who may have gotten himself into a bit of trouble. And there is talk of what that could mean, even possible prosecution.
That's not the president's role. That's the job of the Department of Justice, and something they should certainly look at.
Is that something you'd like to see?
I'm not sure about that specifically, but I think if there's ever a moment where we feel someone's broken the law, particularly if they're the head of the FBI, I think that's something that certainly should be looked at.
Should Comey be prosecuted? That's some pretty strong stuff. The political ramifications of this would be in the oh wow side of things, but I'm not saying it's impossible. It really all depends as to whether Comey was now the stuff. Let me back up for a second. When they look at his conduct with regard to the Hillary email investigation and what he did by stepping out in front of Loretta Lynch, whose job it was as Attorney General to make that statement, but Comey thought it was better. He thought the optics, this is by his own admission, were better if he was the one that told the American people that there would be no charges against Hillary Clinton and that no reasonable prosecutor would do it. Keep in mind, Comey wasn't even a prosecutor at all at the time. He was really a head of an investigatory body, the FBI. But Comey released a memo or the contents of a memo to a journalist, did so willfully and knowingly. And then you get into whether there was anything that that could be considered a criminal violation of statute. Right. Whether that's in fact the case. And if that is the case, you start to wonder, all right, if Comey can do that, if Hillary can do what she did, we really have established that there is a completely special set aside of laws for those who are politically connected and in good favor with the Democrats. If Comey is able to violate the law without any punishment whatsoever. Now, you know, he didn't give away the nuclear codes, right? I mean, this isn't the end of the world. I'm not pretending that this would be some huge case, but would a lower level FBI agent get punished? Would a lower level person in the government receive some form of real punishment for what they did after they left office? I wonder. But the White House knows that this is not over in terms of where Comey and the Mueller investigation, all that's heading. They know that there's a whole other, I don't know if it's just a final act, but there are tricks that they are going to pull going into the future here. They hope that they can take down the administration or at least make life so difficult and so miserable for the administration that they are able to then take back the House, and then, you know, you'll get to whether or not there'll be an impeachment. And I do think that there will be impeachment if the Democrats are able to achieve a majority in the House. They don't need a majority in the Senate necessarily because they won't get removal from office, but just impeachment. And ask Bill Clinton. It was rough. I just thought it was so mean. They were being so mean to me with the impeachment and the whole Monica thing, and it was terrible. The Clintons, isn't it? When you think about it, I know this is a departure from the news of the day for a second, but when you think of the Democrats, I have to say, with the exception of President Obama, because there's nothing in his personal conduct in office that people are already, Warbuck. No, I'm not talking about his policy or how he was or, you know, the legality of things. I'm talking, you know, there was no sex scandal during the Obama administration. But when you look at the Clintons, you look at the Kennedys, I mean, the big names in Democrat politics, and it's just so sleazy. There's so much. And then you get John Edwards. I mean, I could play this game all day. You go down the list. People that are engaged. I don't know what's going on with Anthony Weiner's not of the same stature as those other individuals, particularly the Clintons or the Kennedys. He's not. He was not Democrat royalty, but I mean, clearly he's in a whole lot of trouble. But there's something going on here, right? There's something clearly off about the moral compass of the Democrat Party when it is so supportive of people who are so deeply immoral themselves. And I think that that should matter. Now, I think that with Comey and the Mueller investigation, it is very likely that there won't be any charges. It is very likely that for Comey, I should say, I still believe Mueller is going to get somebody. He's going to find some lower level person and
make an example of them because this is the nature of how this works. It was one of my bigger arguments with some of my friends in law enforcement was whenever I started to feel like because of the resources invested in an investigation, they were pushing for a certain outcome, not based necessarily on it's not that they weren't based on the facts because it was factual, but there's always a judgment call, right? There's always how far do you push this and what's the outcome that you are willing to accept. And a special counsel is not going to accept a press conference where they say no wrongdoing occurred and that's the end of it. I just don't see that happening. So by hitting out at Comey today, Sarah Huckabee Sanders is establishing a narrative that will be used to combat whatever does come out of the Mueller investigation, that Comey and the DOJ under Obama and Loretta Lynch, that there was all kinds of impropriety going on there. And that the political fix was in for those years, and that Republicans have to play not just by a different set of rules, but have to be on guard for the bureaucracy coming after them because of the infiltration of the federal bureaucracy, including the Department of Justice, by what are effectively left-wing activists. So this is how I see it all shaken out.
He's holding the line for America. Buck Sexton is back.
60% out still, I think it is, out of power. But we've gotten a lot restored. We've had over a million restored already. So hopefully the number is going to come down.
That's Governor Scott of Florida talking about what's going on down there right now. You've got millions of people still without power. You've had widespread flooding. But as I've been saying to you, Florida has prepared as well as anyone could have expected or hoped for, really, for this hurricane. And a lot of evacuations took place, which is a good thing when you think about what happened, for example, in the Keys, where I think the statistic that I saw was that 25% of homes, the Florida Keys, were destroyed by this hurricane. I've been out of the Keys a couple times. Really like it. Really beautiful place. I'm sorry they've been battered so badly by this storm. We wanted to take Tim before, but he had a connection problem. Tim, calling in from Louisiana. What's going on?
Yeah. Hey. But going back to Hillary a little bit, she's written a book of excuses, by the way, not reasons, of why she lost to Trump. And I wish somebody would ask her what her excuses are for her loss to a relatively unknown junior senator from Illinois back in 2004.
Yeah, it's not like this was a one-time thing, right? Hillary was the inevitable, definitely going to win candidate for president twice and lost twice.
Exactly. And it's funny that she's not harping on her excuses for losing to Barack Obama.
Yeah, well, I guess that's because she wants to stay in good standing with her fellow Democrats. And anyone paying attention knows that Barack Obama has a much more effective brand and a much more powerful megaphone going forward than Hillary Clinton does. I think there's no question about that.
I agree. And hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, absolutely. Shield side, Tim. Thank you. I know we got you on a better connection there. I appreciate it. All right, so you just wanted to get in some a Hillary caller there, but I want to go back to what's going on with the aftermath of Irma here. You have also Governor Scott talking about the rebuilding effort.
I want to thank the president for the pre-landfall declaration. I want to thank him for the major declaration afterwards. That does not happen all the time. This president and this administration is absolutely focused, like I am, on, one, the safety of everybody, but on top of getting people back to a normal life as fast as possible. So we got a lot of work to do. But everybody's going to come together. We're going to, you know, get this state rebuilt. And this state is a state of strong, resilient people. And we're going to get our jobs back. We're going to help build our companies again. And then we're going to get this all cleaned up and hopefully get more tourists back in our state and get everybody back.
Yeah, there's a lot of coming together that's happened because of these hurricanes. Oh, wait, before I go there, actually. I did get some, the team here, Ty and Amy, brought me some information on Hurricane Jose, which is a Category 1 storm. And I didn't even know that there was Hurricane Katia. I didn't even know about that one. I guess that didn't make landfall or something. It was out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Okay. But Hurricane Jose is waiting out over the Atlantic, and it could. It has maximum sustained winds of 75 miles per hour, and it could hit somewhere in the U.S. I'm not sure where. There are a few different trajectories that they think it could go on, so they don't really know just yet. It could be, I guess, it could be nothing, but it's you got another hurricane out there in the Atlantic right now. So, with all of that happening, there are those stories that we look to. There are those moments that bring us all together when we understand that a natural disaster doesn't have any politics. A natural disaster is a terrifying situation for men, women, and children, our fellow Americans, our fellow human beings. And so we saw a lot of heroism, a lot of fantastic work from first responders and law enforcement and neighbors and people with boats and kayaks and boogie boards, whatever it is they were using to help people. And that's been great. But you also see some of the ugly political prejudices unleashed at times like this from, I don't mean the random, I don't care about random internet trolls, right? I don't spend my time here thinking about the comment section on the Daily Kos or the Huffington Post or really on most websites for that matter. The comment section tends to be something of a literary sewer. But although I will say that also when I worked at The Blaze, you know, when I first went to The Blaze, I was a website writer. That was what they hired me to do. In retrospect, that I turned down, pardon me for saying, some of the best business schools in the world to go work as a writer at a website was a roll of the dice. That was a risk that I took there. But I spent a lot of time looking at the comments on the back end of the website as well and getting a sense of the conservative media business online first. I learned it that way and then came into some of these more traditional mediums like radio and TV. There are things in the comment section. I wish I kept them. I mean, sometimes you'll get somebody who just comments on something and is so incredibly brilliant and incisive that you're like, that is gold right there. That comment is incredible. You do see them. I should start to set them aside, you know, copy and paste them and make a sheet of them. But usually it's in the moment, right? You kind of had to be there reading it at the time. It doesn't necessarily keep. Oh, but that reminds me, I do want to have, and we can do it this Friday. I'll pull some comments off of Facebook and or messages from Facebook. So you go to facebook.com/Buck Sexton. Thoughts for the show, segment ideas, things you like. You want more history, you want more, I don't know, political, philosophical, deep dives, whatever it is, right? You want more of Bernie? Who doesn't want more of the Burn? The Burn's amazing. Whatever it may be, you can tell me on Facebook, and I'll try to share some comments there. Something to add into our Freestyle Friday for those of you who don't call in on the phones. All right, let me get this Buck train back on the tracks here, because I was talking about the politics that you see during and after a natural disaster, and it was a window into the mindset of the left. The climate change stuff, I don't know how much time I'll have to get into that today or not. I've been meaning to, but the short version is that the arguments for hurricanes as evidence of climate change are so flimsy as to be laughable, but the people that make them are completely psychotic with how much they believe it. I mean, and you're hearing more about how they want to punish politicians that don't believe in climate change. And you saw really horrible stuff. And I saw this was on the Bill Maher show, where I was in the audience on Friday. I was just there because SE Cup is a dear friend, and I was supporting her, and Molly had never seen the show, so I was there. You'll notice they've never had me on the show to this day. They know about me. They've had a lot of people on the show that I think make much less interesting guests than me, who are conservatives, but they've never had me on the show. And at this point, given that it's been a few years and they've interviewed me and they know all about me, I got to figure they never will, which is fine. You know, they're allowed to not have me on the show, but I got to think, I wonder why that is. I wonder what it is about Bill Maher. People all know me, and yet they never invite me on the show. invited. And the show that I went to see, I mean, they invited, what's the guy's name with the red sweater? I can't even remember, but I was sitting there in the audience. Ken Bone, isn't that right? They had the red sweater guy there who's like, well, you know, here I am, and I'm just like a normal guy, and don't listen to me on politics. And I'm not trying to be mean, but the guy's up there, and he says, don't listen to me, I'm just an average guy. And then we get to hear him talk for 20 minutes about politics with Bill Maher, one-on-one. Like, I'm getting a lecture from this guy.
He's like, well, I think that we really need more centrism and to come back to the center. And
I thought you said, don't listen to me. I'm going to have some tips for public speaking later on in the show that I... It's not really tips so much as lessons learned from my end of things. And we have that viral video, or audio, this is a radio show, viral audio of this guy from the side. You have to stay with me to the end of the show today because we've got some great stuff planned for you. It's going to be amazing. But on the Bill Maher show, you saw this willingness to celebrate the destructive power of the storm as something that is a punishment for political enemies. You know, there were jokes made about Rush, to whom I am forever grateful for giving me the honor of filling in for him a few times. They were making jokes, and I'm sitting in the audience. I mean, it was uncomfortable for me. I mean, I had no part of it, but I just happened to be there. And they're making jokes about how Rush had to evacuate his home, and they're making, and you've seen others out there too. You know, the leftist comedians in the world about how, oh, look what happened to Houston. You know, maybe if they believed in climate change, this wouldn't have happened to them. I mean, really horrific, vile stuff. And I should note that, you know, not that it matters at all, but Houston actually votes Democrat predominantly. So, you know, it's just these people are not just unthinking and unfeeling, but they're also idiots on top of that and making really bad arguments that are really nasty and vicious. And you've seen a lot of that. And I am always on the lookout for it because it distresses me when I see conservatives. I can't speak about random people. I'm talking about people who have followings, who have influence in the conversation, who have their own TV shows. There are people like that. You know, this guy, who's Michael Ian Black, right? Is he's this guy's got like 2 million Twitter followers. Writes just insane stuff about climate change, really nasty, horrible stuff about climate change. I mean, just maniac stuff. And he's got 2 million Twitter followers. I'm not talking, again, this isn't the comments section. These are the supposed luminaries of the left, or if not luminaries, at least the celebrities of the left. And on climate change, they've been just, they've used the hurricanes for this argument, and it's just nonsense. It's such low-level trash from them, and at a time when people are really suffering and bad things are happening to really good people, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, like millions of people. I mean, think about what a disruption in your life it is to abandon your home and just the anxiety of what's going to happen in my home. You know, what if people always think, okay, well, maybe the flooding on the first floor, but what if power lines get knocked down and there's a fire? You know, what if a tree gets knocked down and puts a huge hole in my living room, basically totals my house, right? These are the real concerns of people out there. But there is, at its core, something, well, because it really has no central moral guiding compass, American progressivism has a nastiness. It pretends to be it's all about emotions, but it's not about kindness. And that's why you see people with such large followings and such influence in the conversation who can just be so mean. That's why you see a cartoon showing, you know, secessionist Texans making stupid comments about the federal government as they're being airlifted from the flood or whatever. You know, that cartoon that really was a window into the mind of the people in D.C. who make a lot of the calls about the news cycle and about what you read, what you see, what you hear. That's what they think of other parts of the country. And they're so stupid as to make a cartoon like that that's not only cruel and disgraceful, but also just ignorant, right? Houston is the hotbed of secessionist, anti-government, right-wing extremism. It's so dumb as to be almost beyond worthy of any kind of comment. But these are not randoms. These are not just people posting on the web. These are people with followings. These are people with influence in the conversation. That's what I find so distressing. I didn't even get into the anti-government stuff that they're saying comes from her, you know, that the hurricanes show, but I got, as you can tell, I get a little bit hot and bothered there. So I'm going to bring it. I'm going to bring it back to neutral. I'm going to recharge my battery. Welcome back to the Freedom Hut. Buck Sexton here with you all, team. Biggest story on Drudge right now, the main banner on the Drudge Report is, well, the title is Waiver Issued So Construction of Border Wall Can Begin. Here's some of the text from the story, which just went up as I, okay, maybe it went up a little earlier than when I came on air, but it went up pretty close to when I came on air. The Department of Homeland Security has issued a waiver to waive certain laws, regulations, and other legal requirements to ensure the expeditious construction of barriers in the vicinity of the international border near Calexico, California. The waiver was first published in the Federal Register today. This waiver is pursuant to authority granted to the Secretary of Homeland Security by Congress and covers a variety of environmental, natural resource, and land management laws. The department has actually, okay, blah, 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 more and more stuff here. So they're making it possible for more waivers, or making it possible for more construction on a border wall near Calexico in California. So does this mean, now this is DHS, right? So this comes within the executive branch. This would seem to be, perhaps I'm getting ahead of myself, this would seem to be an indicator that there is some desire on the part of the Trump administration to start moving with wall stuff. What was it we had on the show earlier in the week? One of our guests, I forget which one it was now, saying, guests, I have so many fantastic guests, some of them blend together. But saying that he thought the only place where we would, where you would not be able to see a policy retreat from Donald Trump, the only place where you could really expect that would be on the wall. That if he ever says, you know what, the wall's just not going to happen, then even his most ardent supporters, even those who just refuse to back down an inch despite everything, who was it? Thank you. It was Michael Goodman of the New York Post. I'd forgotten. That's where the, if you will, the wall is where the line is drawn. And I think that may be true. I think that would be a difficult place because everything, with everything else, there's some degree of negotiation, right? Tax reform, negotiation. Repeal and replace, I don't know. That's pretty straightforward, and that hasn't happened. So it's not so good. You know, it's not so good. But on the wall, you're either building a wall or you're not. It is a pretty binary thing. It's either yes or no, yay or nay. And I would have to think that somehow Trump is going to push for this. But I should also note, and maybe I'll have to get into more detail about this in the coming up here right after the break, that there was reporting today that Trump does not expect that there will not be any wall-specific funding or language in whatever Congress comes up within this six-month window to address the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, DACA. If they're not going to use DACA as leverage to get a wall, when are they going to get a wall? I'm going to be watching this one closely. I'm starting to get a little bit uneasy with the whole idea of like, well, you know, it's really early on and you get, okay, but there are some signs here that we can look at. There are some early data points that when you connect the dots, when you look at what's going on, you got to start thinking, okay, so Trump was never going to be the hardline conservative the media said that he was to try and scare people, but now I think you'd have to start to say that Trump just defies political ideological categorization, in that at the end of the day, he's just going to be Trump. Trump will be Trump.
He's back with you now, because when it comes to the fight for truth, the buck never stops.
Buck Sexton here, team. I I hope that you will get a chance, if you haven't already, to subscribe to this show on iTunes. Great way to subscribe to the podcast. Also, if you want to share it with a friend, which I very much appreciate, it is incredibly helpful to me if you would be willing to do so. You can share the podcast. People can listen whenever, anytime they want. And on the iHeart app, which is a great way to listen to any number of things, but particularly the Buck Sexton Show, if you have the iHeart app, you just go to Buck Sexton with America Now, and you click it, and it's the show is always streaming there. So you can always just join the show and listen to it whenever you want, however you want. So just putting that out there, and that's a way for someone's like, hey, I can't listen to Buck. He's not in my area. Be like, oh, I'm sorry. Do you have a smartphone? Do you have Wi-Fi or cell service? You can listen to Buck Sexton with America Now. Isn't it an amazing country we live in? Also, I wish I had insights to offer you about the iPhone X and 8. I don't really, other than to say that the description sounds like, I mean, this does sound like the opening sequence of like a Terminator movie or something. It's a little scary. Here's what they say about the iPhone X. The iPhone X is a new smartphone from Apple, et cetera, et cetera. The phone will feature an all-glass design, yada, yada. The A11 Bionic chip with neural engine, Q1 wireless charging, and an improved rear camera with dual optical image stabilization. That's A1, like this. That's a steak sauce, right? A11 Bionic chip. That sounds scary. That sounds like if I get a little uppity with my smartphone, it may turn my appliances against me or something, which I should note could happen in the future. You add AI, artificial intelligence, to the Internet of Things, the IoT, which is the connectivity and the sensors deployed to all kinds of devices in your home. Oh, that's right. I'm nerding out with some technology knowledge. Then bad things can happen. Then scary things can happen. So there is that. I have our friend. Oh, I got a little bit. My digression is throwing me off today. I'm feeling it's one of these days where I'm just letting it rip. Ben Domenech will be joining us in just a few minutes, and I want to give him a lot of time to discuss a couple of topics with us. So I'm going to go into a break here in just a few. But before I do so, I just want to note that they're taking this whole, I mentioned it in the last hour, they're taking this whole single payer thing, the Democrats are, very seriously. And the New York Times has a, I read the papers I subscribe to, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. I read all of them. I mean, not all of every paper, obviously, but I'm saying those are the papers that I, newspapers that I read. I probably shouldn't be supporting them financially, but if I'm going to tear apart the Times and the Post, I've got to have access to the Times and the Post. Anyway, this Times piece says that there's been a jump in support among Democrats. No, I guess that's not really surprising at all, for a government-run healthcare system. It's now 63%. 63% of Democrats support a government-run healthcare system. So that's pretty astonishing. And support overall for a government-run healthcare system is 43%. I should note that to get to single payer, it's not like all of a sudden you just don't have any bills. There would have to be massive transformations in the actual existing healthcare system, and what happens to insurance companies? What purpose do they serve? And at the end of the day, this is just going to, it'll just be ruinously expensive. I mean, taxes on the middle class will have to skyrocket. Taxes on everybody will have to, everyone who pays taxes at least, which is half the country only, or I think it's less than half the country now, their taxes are all going to really go up. And if you think that you're going to get good health care when the government is paying the bills, I got news for you. That is not the case. But you don't think that. You know that this is a terrible idea, but Democrats are going to go with it. It, like minimum wage, it sounds appealing. The reality, the truth behind single payer, by the time we figure it out, it'll be Democrats in power for so long that we won't even remember what it's like to have a discussion about a free market in healthcare. That's the plan. This is one of the built-in failures, unfortunately, of a republic like ours, in that accountability is an imperfect thing, and that's putting it mildly. And if you are able to game the system such that whoever makes certain decisions now will never be around to be held accountable for them in the future, and the political party just maintains its power, you know, you never throw out the guys who are doing the bad stuff. You never manage to get to a better system of governance because there's no real accountability. And on single payer with Democrats, that's what will happen. Just like by the time we really see how terrible Obamacare would have been, no one will blame Obama for it anymore. Welcome back, team. Buck here with you in the Freedom Hut. We've got Ben Domenech on the line as our guest right now. He is the publisher of The Federalist and host of The Federalist Radio Hour. You can read his latest on thefederalist.com. Mr. Domenech, great to have you back, sir.
Great to be with you as always, Buck.
So I have to confess, I do not know anything about this person, Jemele Hill, but I see you've written a piece on Jemele Hill. What is going on here?
So Jemele Hill is...
Oh, Jemele, pardon me.
That's fine. Of the 6 o'clock ESPN Sports Center, the, you know, marquee show, obviously, of ESPN. And just the other night, she went on a bit of a rant in the middle of Monday Night Football on Twitter, where she started to essentially go after Donald Trump and his supporters. Of all things, it was actually inspired by a conversation that I think began because people were arguing about Kid Rock and whether he was inappropriate or a white supremacist or something like that. She weighed in with a bunch of tweets calling Trump a white supremacist, saying that he was elevated only because he was a white supremacist and a white person, and said a bunch of other pretty nasty things. And there was some blowback for it, as you might expect, from a lot of people who were demanding that, you know, she justify what she was saying and things like that. ESPN, however, as you know, has been very defensive of their anchor's ability to weigh in on anything political that they want to say, as long as it comes from the left. They've been a little more, preventive when it comes to their staffers saying things that lean right. And so in this case, they put out a statement that doesn't even amount to a slap on the wrist. They basically said, we've discussed the matter with Jemele and she agrees it was inappropriate, was the statement they put out this afternoon. Buck, we're talking about somebody who was elevated to co-hosting this 6 p.m. hour of ESPN. And ESPN, as you know, has been a place that has seen a pretty significant decline in ratings in recent years. And a lot of people not just cutting the cord, but, you know, not wanting to get it anymore. And the argument that the ESPN folks advance is that this, has to do with just people, you know, watching games on mobile devices and not really, you know, tuning into the channel anymore. I would argue that it's actually because of people like Jemele Hill, who don't just make everything political when they have the opportunity, but make for pretty boring television. And if you tune into that hour, I would argue you see a set that looks like it hasn't changed in essentially 20 years, and something that looks a lot like local television, but with two fairly boring co-hosts who spend a lot more time politically posturing than they do talking about sports, which is what most people turn into ESPN to see.
I think that, and I'm not somebody who watches a lot of sports, so I'll put that out. I do watch, but I certainly don't watch commentary about sports. I don't, that's not my thing. I mean, for folks who love that, by all means. But, you know, when I hear that they're, as a radio guy, I hear people listening to a 3-hour-long radio show about a sporting event, I don't know. It doesn't appeal to me. I feel like the leftist tilt, though, that we see from a lot of the sports commentariat is a relatively new thing, but it, and it's also, there's a kind of unabashed quality to it all. Like this is, mm-hmm. It's now out there. They don't care. They're fine with it. ESPN is fine with it. Where do you think this came from? I mean, it's not like all of a sudden there are progressives in our midst who decided they wanted to get into sports. Can you identify the shift? What happened?
Yeah. So there are a couple of things that happened. I think most of all, though, what we're actually seeing here at Buck is a bias among media types who think that their audience is like them. So, for instance, if you talk to a media type who works at ESPN, I've interviewed a couple on my own radio show, they'll say things like, well, nobody really watches highlights anymore. They just you know, watch those on Twitter. They don't really want to see those anymore. They want to see commentary. Well, the truth is most people don't use Twitter. actually, most Americans don't use it, you know, and certainly some do. And when they do, they might look for highlights there. But the fact is that lots of people like to see highlight shows, and that's what ESPN sort of built their whole model on. The other problem that they have really is that on the sort of virtue signaling side, the fact is that most of these reporters come from backgrounds where they went to Northwestern, they went to Syracuse, they went to a lot of different, you know, schools that are known for their journalism programs. They have left-of-center views. I think the difference now is that with the advent of social media, they have a new opportunity to express those views in ways that get an immediate response from the viewers and from people online, and that this response often frustrates them, makes them angry, makes them double down, which is what you'll see if you look back and see what Jemele Hill was writing last night. She was kind of doubling down on this idea, you know, well, no, it's not just that he's wrong. It's not just that he's unfit. It's that he's a white supremacist, and he's supported by white supremacists and surrounded by white supremacists. And I think that what that really equates to is it's virtue signaling for them to their colleagues about how brave they are, you know, for standing up for what they believe in. But the fact is, you know, Buck, when, 10, 20 years ago, before the advent of social media, you wouldn't have really been able to tell the politics of anybody who was talking about sports on TV. You wouldn't necessarily know. You know, you might. I mean,
I have to jump in because this is what I think some of the folks even at CNN and MSNBC don't understand, is that you can't have Jim Acosta or Jim Sciutto or anyone else at the networks named Jim, who's a big correspondent, tweeting about, you know, how Trump is an idiot at 9 a.m. and then going on a news broadcast at 6 p.m. and want to be treated as a nonpartisan independent journalist. It doesn't work that way.
You're 100% correct. Imagine the attitude that would have had, obviously, one of the most famous duos in the history of ESPN is Keith Olbermann and Kenny Mayne. Okay, they would host a Sports Center together. They were very funny. They were very biting. You didn't know. You could have paid attention and figured out that Keith Olbermann was a liberal. Okay, but imagine if Keith Olbermann at that time had Twitter, had the ability to sort of come off a set at ESPN and then start ranting and raving about politics and his particular views. The fact that he didn't protected his ability to be a sportscaster who could be enjoyed by right and left alike. And I think right now the fact that there is no barrier, there is no filter for that sort of thing, it doesn't just hurt the business of sports. It does, as you say, also hurt our ability to take any of these people seriously when they try to pretend like they don't have a particular viewpoint and then spend the rest of their day complaining about the president or about the Republican Party or about the president's supporters.
We're speaking to Ben Domenech. He's the publisher of The Federalist, host of The Federalist Radio Hour. Federalist is one of my favorite sites. I commend it to all of you. You should go check it out. If you're not already bookmarking it in your browser, you should. Ben, you're a guy who can cover a lot of ground, so I want to take advantage of that if I can for a moment here. Mm-hmm. Your take on the deal that Trump struck with Pelosi and Schumer. What is it?
Okay, so to back up a step, thank you, first of all, for saying those nice things about The Federalist. But in May at The Federalist, I actually wrote a piece that argued that Donald Trump needed to pivot to the middle in order to save himself from impeachment. And the argument that I had at the time was essentially Democrats are going to run in 2018, and whether they admit it or not, they will, if they take the House, attempt to impeach President Trump. And they don't even really need a justification. It's just that they're hardcore.
Yeah, he's Trump.
Really wants them to do it. Exactly. He's Donald Trump. That's the justification. And so my argument was actually that, you know, if we look back historically, there's a situation for a president that actually compares a lot to Donald Trump, and that's Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton, in his first year in office, had, you know, struggled with the health care issue. He had a special prosecutor by middle of the year that was looking into his a bunch of different things related to his situation. There was a real backlash against his election in a lot of different ways. And you had a White House that had a lot of upheaval, that had a bunch of different staffers come in and out in the ongoing months. That led to, obviously, a wave election in 1994 that damaged him. But the fact is that after that election, Bill Clinton changed. He triangulated. He decided he was going to work with Republicans on some issues and Democrats on other issues. As you know, Donald Trump is really an independent politically. He is not truly a Republican. He's not truly a Democrat. He's been all over the map on a lot of different things in his career. He knows Chuck Schumer. He gets along with Chuck Schumer. They're both from the boroughs. And I think that when you look at their relationship, they're a lot closer personally than Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell are to Trump. Ryan and McConnell came to Trump back in January, and they said, we'll have a repeal bill on your desk by Easter. We'll have a tax bill on your desk by August. And then we'll spend the latter part of the year on infrastructure. Obviously, they haven't delivered on any of those things. And so for a guy who's a political neophyte like Trump, he looks around and basically says, hey, if I can't trust you guys to get stuff done, maybe I should work with the other people. And I think in this situation, that's thoroughly logical. Now, the problem, of course, is, you know, for Trump, he's going to need to be able to cut deals with Democrats that Republicans will also still be able to support. That's not necessarily going to be the best policy for the country, Buck. I think that that's going to lead to a lot of things I'm going to dislike. But if it turns out to be politically feasible for Trump to do that, and I think it probably is, it's actually going to be something that's probably going to help him have a lot more effective presidency and prevent him from being in a position where Democrats can afford to be 100% aligned against him. I would love to see what would happen, Buck, if tomorrow the president came out and announced that he was going to support a hike in the minimum wage, but also a work requirement for every welfare program that we have in the country. That would be a very difficult vote for a lot of Democrats to take, because of course they're opposed to those work requirements, but the minimum wage hike has been something that they've been beating, you know, the drum on for ages. And it's the sort of thing that Trump, alone among Republican, you know, presidential candidates in this past cycle, could potentially offer them because of things that he said in the past. So I don't know if it'll work out, but I think that in terms of his own success, it's not an illogical move on his part. And even if it's made out of animosity towards Ryan and McConnell, it does make some political sense.
Ben, one more for you, and I appreciate you calling in here. Ben's from The Federalist, everybody, where he is the publisher. Ben, what would it take for Trump's real base, his original supporters back in the very beginning of the primary when there were, what, 17 candidates and people that have been with him all along and really believe, what do you think it would take in terms of policy for them to finally say, whoa, that's not okay?
Mm-hmm. I think that it would take a couple of things. I think one, one aspect would be, and I think that this should not be underestimated, is if he actually gets us involved in a war. I think a lot of his supporters, you know, viewed him as someone who would prevent something like that, who would end wars and not, you know, get us involved in new ones. I also think that they would have a different attitude towards him, frankly, if he stopped being the kind of force against what they view as political correctness and the forces that are involved there. I think that that would actually peel a lot of people off. A telling factor from this past week was the fact that you saw Betsy DeVos, the education secretary, come out and roll back a number of things that announced that she was going to be rolling back a number of things related to President Obama's Title IX policy. That didn't get a lot of blowback or attention in the media, but it's a significant factor. And it's one of those things that I think flows into his whole conversation about freedoms that relate to speech and issues like that on not just on campuses, but in the public square. That's something that I think keeps his loyalists so close to him. And frankly, this is always a binary. As much as people dislike Trump or as they dislike some of these other Republican candidates, the fact is that they look across at the other party. They look at what they're being told. They look at people like Jemele Hill, who say that anybody who supports the president is a white supremacist. And they say, well, guess what? I'm not going to go along with you then. I'm supposed to vote for your person now because they think that I'm racist. That's something that I think is so fundamental to what's going on right now. As long as Democrats continue to wrap themselves in this identity politics that says that anything traditionalist, anything patriotic is in support of something evil and racist, then they're never going to be able to make inroads with the kind of people who were frankly decisive voters for President Obama twice and then for then for Donald Trump in the last election.
Ben Domenech of The Federalist. Go check out TheFederalist.com. Ben, thanks so much for your time today, buddy. Appreciate it.
Great to be with you as always, Buck. Take care.
He's holding the line for America. Buck Sexton is back.
We are facing a couple of very difficult obstacles. First, the other side has dedicated propaganda channels. That's what I call Fox News.
Right.
It has outlets like Breitbart and, you know, crazy InfoWars and things like that. In this particular election, it was aided and abetted by the Russians and the role that Facebook and other platforms played. We are late to that. You know, we did not understand how a reality TV campaign would so dominate the media environment. I think the Democrats can do a lot, but they are still going to face a very difficult media environment. And we've got to figure out how we're going to break through. I mean, obviously, more podcasts, more other ways of communicating so voices can be heard and real positions can be understood is part of it, but we're still at a disadvantage.
There we have Hillary Clinton explaining to us that she lost the election because there aren't enough liberal media outlets out there. Wow, she is brazen. I almost respect it if I didn't despise it so much. But she has this book out, which is called What Happened, as I've been talking about on the show. And we have somebody who's joining us now who has been reading through the book and can discuss that as well as some other issues of politics right now. Sarah Westwood is on the line. She's a White House correspondent for The Washington Examiner. Sarah, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, this book, What Happened? Tell me about it. What's in it?
Well, this is kind of Hillary Clinton's way of starting to rehabilitate her image after what was clearly a devastating loss for her personally, for her party. It's kind of a mix of these personal justifications of why she chose to be evasive on things like her Wall Street speeches or the Clinton Foundation, and also casting blame on the Democratic Party, on Senator Bernie Sanders, on the media, like in the snippet you just played, on President Trump himself. And a lot of people have taken this to be this blame game book where she's going through and she's laying responsibility at the feet of everyone who cost her the election without really fully acknowledging the role that her own flaws played in losing the election. And as far as Democrats go, there are not a whole lot of them in elected office right now who seem to be excited that this is coming out, because she's a deeply unpopular figure still. And her presence on the national stage doesn't really help them sort out the divisions they have in their party right now.
What can you tell me about the blame that's being thrown at the burn? That's been getting a lot of headlines. Bernie Sanders getting some rough stuff in this book from Hillary Clinton and from her book tour.
Well, Hillary Clinton is making the argument that some Democrats agree with, that Bernie Sanders paved the way for Donald Trump to use his successful crooked Hillary attacks by introducing this narrative that she was somehow withholding something nefarious from her paid speeches to Wall Street when she refused to release the transcripts. That started during the Democratic primary. But Senator Bernie Sanders chose deliberately not to go after Hillary Clinton for her emails. He waged what I think a lot of people consider to be a very issues-based campaign. And she highlights the fact that he is an independent. He's not a registered Democrat. He's never really claimed to be a member of the Democratic Party, making the argument that he didn't get into the Democratic primary to elevate a Democrat to the White House, but to disrupt the left. And she said ultimately that wasn't helpful to her chances.
We're speaking to Sarah Westwood. She is a White House correspondent for The Washington Examiner. Sarah, tax reform is an issue that's getting a lot of attention now because it's the major policy agenda item that the Trump administration says is up next. We have not seen a lot of success on the legislative front with this White House so far, but it is still early. What can you tell us about where things stand on tax reform and the possibilities of getting Democrats to come along?
Well, tonight, President Trump is making an overture to Democrats in the Senate that he'll need to get on board by inviting three of them, along with three Republicans, to the White House for dinner. He's been making these overtures to Democrats who are vulnerable in 2018, who are up for re-election in states where Trump is popular, who might need to be seen embracing the president. And so that's going to be really the key here. Remember that at the end of September, which is coming up really soon, Republicans will lose their ability to pass tax reform using just 51 votes. So no matter what happens, they're going to need to get eight Democrats on their side. President Trump is just starting that pivot a little bit earlier than I think Republicans expected him to, and he's starting to try to make his case to those Democrats.
Sarah Huckabee Sanders said as much earlier today.
Most everyone can agree that Americans should keep more of their money than the government. They spend it certainly far better than the government can. And I think that's something that is a common goal that a lot of people want to come together on. I think by nature of them sitting down with the president, that's a very good first start. The president, I think, has demonstrated both in his business world and as president that he can make deals. And that's certainly what he's looking to do. And he's going to work hard to make sure that we get the best deal possible on tax reform.
What would a deal look like, though, with Democrats? I mean, what do we have any sense of that? I assume the Democrats are already trying to, you know, set the table here a bit. What would they need to go forward with a tax cut?
Well, that very question was put to Sarah Sanders today, and she couldn't quite answer it. And notice that what she was talking about there was a tax cut. It was not tax reform, which is what Republicans have been pushing for, to make fundamental changes to the tax code that make filing your taxes easier, that close some of the loopholes. And that's often politically unpopular because it involves getting at what Democrats would characterize as tax cuts for the rich or for corporations, even though it's making structural changes to the tax code. And so because of that, I think the White House seems to be setting its sights right now just on getting a tax cut for the middle class or people who could really use it, and not necessarily focusing on the tax reform that was originally the goal of Republicans once they got control of all three branches of government.
Any word, by the way, on the looming border battle? I mean, I see here main header on Drudge: waiver issued so construction of border battle can begin.
Well, the problem is that it's not clear how hard the White House is going to fight for funding for the border wall or some of these other immigration enforcement priorities when it comes to a DACA protections bill. I know it's been out there that President Trump has asked Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer if this is something he'd be willing to consider. But it's really difficult to see some of these further left politicians voting for anything that cracks down on illegal immigration.
Yeah, even as part of a package. I think you're right. I think it's going to be too hard for the Democrats to swallow that one. Sarah Westwood, everybody. She is a White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Read her latest on WashingtonExaminer.com. Sarah, great stuff. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
You are now Freedom Hut Tactical Operations Center. All sensitive programs must be kept strictly need to know.
They're clear.
Team Buck is cleared.
Roger that.
And ready for the Buck Brief.
Wargaming can often be a deeply unsettling and even terrifying exercise. The case of North Korea these days and the options that the U.S. has on hand to deal with this belligerent nuclear power on the Korean Peninsula is no exception to that. In fact, some of the options that we might have to consider in the future are exactly the kind of things that keep the most grizzled veteran Pentagon analysts and think tank wonks up late at night wondering about what the future of this world will really be. Now, I don't mean to overstate the case. There is an overwhelming likelihood that North Korea will continue in some form of status quo for the months ahead and probably even years. But in order to understand the full scope and all of the possibilities on the Korean Peninsula, let's look at the various options for dealing with North Korea. You just had earlier this week the UN Security Council pass a resolution that would enhance the already very strict sanctions on the so-called Hermit Kingdom. Now, initially, Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, had wanted there to be a complete embargo on all oil to North Korea. North Korea relies on China for a large portion of its oil, and at least of its liquid fossil fuels. And the idea here is that if you were to completely cut off that supply, it is very possible that you would have major economic dislocations inside North Korea. And also, you might get Pyongyang's attention because it needs fossil fuels, liquid fossil fuels, not just for its vehicles, but also in manufacturing processes and for its war machine in general. We didn't get a full embargo, though. The UN Security Council has China and Russia on it as permanent members with the ability to veto, and so there had to be some backroom negotiating. There will be a limitation put upon North Korean exports, and that will hurt hard currency reserves inside of North Korea, which may get Kim Jong-un's attention at some level. And we did not get a complete freeze of all of Kim Jong-un's assets abroad, which also Nikki Haley had wanted from the get-go. But there are some aspects of this that we can be pleased about, but we also need to understand that while it's a win in the diplomacy column for the Trump administration, it is very unlikely to be enough. It is not going to be the case that this will alone change the trajectory of the North Korean militaristic, hyper-militaristic project of achieving nuclear weapons that are, well, nuclear devices that go on top of ICBMs, which would allow them to hit the U.S. mainland. So what are the, I should also note, and this is just an interesting aside, that even if China had gone forward with the most extreme sanctions that were being discussed, so if China said, we will shut off all oil exports to North Korea, North Korea has substantial coal deposits, and there's reason to believe that they already have the technological know-how to engage in coal liquefaction, which would let them fill up the shortfall in gas, in oil. So they could take coal and liquefy it. There is a process through which they could do that, and they probably could do that with a sufficient capacity to make up for the loss in fossil fuels. And even if it wasn't entirely made up for, well, this is a country that has been dealing with deprivation of all kinds for decades. And we should note that the suffering of North Korea, while we think that it puts pressure on the Kim regime, it really just brings together the North Korean people in their exclusion from the rest of the world and in their sense that they are a besieged people. But we also have to keep in mind the ideology of the North Korean state as we look at all these different options. UN Security Council is ratcheting up the pressure. That's good. There are a number of places where more can be done, and I think the Trump administration will do more in order to increase the pain in the upper ranks of North Korea when it comes to their military programs, their nuclear programs, their missile tests. And that won't stop them, but it may at least slow things down. They may make Kim Jong-un think twice about some of his actions, which, keep in mind, recently he was talking about firing missiles in the direction of Guam, which is U.S. territory. But as I've been telling you, the North Korean regime is all about reunification of the Korean Peninsula by force. And they have been preparing the North Korean people for this for decades. So then we get into what would we do in response? Now, if there were a North Korean military incursion into South Korea, or if they fired a missile at us, one of our allies, or at South Korea, when we had any reason to believe that it was a nuclear missile, I don't even know if we would wait to figure that out. The retaliatory response would be tremendous. But what if North Korea engaged in a slower offensive that wasn't based on nuclear weapons? How quickly would we escalate, and to what degree would we be willing to escalate on, say, behalf of South Korea or Japan? There's a very interesting piece that didn't get nearly enough attention. It came out last month. It was a think tank piece on attitudes towards the use of nuclear weapons. And I wrote about this on thehill.com today under the title, Americans May Actually Support Nuking North Korea First. Now, it's a provocative title. I make no bones about it. I mean, that is, in fact, a title meant to get people's attention because I want them to read the rest of the piece. And what I go into is an analysis of this survey of Americans that shows that in a military conflict started by the other side, but that doesn't even really make that much difference in terms of the morality at play. In a military conflict, a majority of Americans, this includes Democrats and Republicans, that were polled in this survey would be willing to use force, missile strikes, perhaps even up to and including nuclear strikes, although that was not specified, missile strikes to kill 100,000 civilians to protect 20,000 U.S. soldiers. A near majority, 48%, according to this this International Security Journal study, almost half would be willing to kill 2 million civilians to protect 20,000 U.S. troops. Now, if you're going to kill 2 million civilians, it stands to reason that you'd be willing to use a nuclear weapon to accomplish that, although that is an extrapolation from the actual exercise we're talking about here, this actual think tank piece. But the American opinion on the notion of massive use of force is not what I think some think tankers and others have believed for a long time. There is a nuclear taboo, they call it. This is what they refer to. This is how they refer to it in international relations circles. And the nuclear taboo is essentially that nuclear weapons are so terrible that there's almost no reason, no rationale that anyone can come up with, short of existential self-defense, that anyone would use nuclear weapons. But if you were to push that a bit further, I think what you see is that, depending on the circumstances, the U.S. and other countries with nukes may in fact feel threatened enough or decide that it is the less horrific option to have a, well, not just a massive aerial strike, but even a nuclear strike to disable the enemy's warfighting capability and to protect our troops and our people. So it's really a philosophical question, but I think that it's far too easy for us to just suggest that we have all these nukes and would never use them. If all of a sudden Kim Jong-un loaded up a bunch of VX gas and was pointing it at 30,000 U.S. troops across the DMZ, are we really so sure that we wouldn't respond to that imminent threat with a nuclear retaliation, or at least a massive military retaliation that would result in tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of casualties? These are difficult questions, and I understand that, and it's not something that I by any means want to spend too much time thinking about. But when we're looking at the crisis in the Korean Peninsula, I think we do have to consider that all options on the table may mean just that.
He's back with you now, because when it comes to the fight for truth, the buck never stops.
Hey team, it's Buck Sexton. I know that I could be accused of bucksplaining here, or mansplaining perhaps. I know that this may be a moment where I could be criticized for trying to protect the patriarchy in some way, but I saw this piece, and it is really worthwhile, and it's important, and I don't care that it's not politically correct. I don't care that the feminist liberal left would decry it for a whole bunch of reasons. It's important. There are young people who listen to this show, including a whole bunch of college-aged men and women. And for female college-aged listeners, this is a must-read piece in the Wall Street Journal. It was written by Jennifer Braceras, and she's just a lawyer and a writer in Boston. And here's what she writes. Straight talk for college women. Be prudent about alcohol and know that school administrators don't have your interests at heart. Let me give you some of what Ms. Braceras writes in the piece. Quote, dear female members of the class of 2021, now that you've set up your rooms and purchased your course materials, it's time for some straight talk about sexual assault. If you follow the news, you've probably heard that 1 in 4 of you will be sexually assaulted on campus before graduation. Don't panic. Your parents did not drop you and your belongings in a crime zone. Claims of a campus rape crisis are wildly inflated, and a little common sense will go a long way toward keeping you safe. The assertion that nearly a quarter of all college women are sexually assaulted is based on surveys that ask vaguely worded questions about behavior ranging from an unexpected kiss to rape. In analyzing the responses, those who lump all such conduct into a catch-all category of sexual assault deliberately create a false impression in order to promote their view of the campus as a rape culture. The truth is, you are far less likely to be raped than women your age who are not in college. The Justice Department estimates approximately 1 in 53 college women will be victims of rape or sexual assault, an unacceptable number, but hardly an epidemic. And quote. So then she goes into what the campuses are doing about this after stating, and it's very important that we all know this, that rape culture is really a terrible lie, that the campus rape epidemic is an instance of politically motivated hysteria, not based in the facts, built upon a tremendous amount of dishonesty. But there is the very real possibility for any young woman on a college campus of a sexual assault, of a rape. And it is much more likely to be an acquaintance rape than a stranger. And so if we're going to try to help young women navigate this culture of drinking and hookup culture on campus, I think it's time that we speak honestly about the best ways to approach this. And this is not, and the author of this piece makes this point as well, but I've been saying this for some time, it's not about victim blaming. There's no excuse for sexual assault. There's no excuse for rape. It is a felony. It is a serious crime and should be punished as such. This is not don't wear a short skirt. This is not don't go to parties. This is not don't drink at parties. It's just guidelines that will keep women not just safer on campus, but I think make them happier. And I am somebody who is a proponent of enjoying yourself in school. I am not a Puritan. I'm not somebody who pretends that I didn't do a lot of partying and probably a bit too much drinking in my day in college. And I've always enjoyed going out on dates, but I've had girlfriends in my life. I've had people that I was building a relationship with. I have not been somebody who was a proponent of this blackout party, make out with whomever is near to you and see what happens. And that's what goes on a lot of these campuses. So here's some of the advice that is written in this Wall Street Journal piece. And I agree, and this is written by a woman, but I am endorsing it. I agree wholeheartedly with this. Here are the bullet points. Do not get drunk and go home with someone you don't know. Very simple, but very good advice. Not just because you put yourself at a higher risk for a sexual assault, which statistically is true, but because it's just not smart decision making. It's not going to lead to, in many cases, sometimes it'll be fine. I know people that have gotten completely, you know, off their butts drunk, and the first time they were ever together, that's how it was, and now they're married and have kids. Okay, so I'm not saying that it means that something bad is going to happen, but just in the aggregate or overall, if you're looking at decision making, do not go home drunk with someone you don't know. It's just good advice. Another one, reject the hookup culture. And this is not so much an issue of preventing sexual assault, although that does play a role in this as well, as it is women will be happier when they on campus when they hold the men around them to a certain standard. She writes in this piece, sex without trust and commitment often ends poorly. It may sound old-fashioned, but it's really common sense. If you don't know someone well and you're unsure whether you can trust him, is it really a good idea to be alone with him in a state of partial undress? It's just good advice. Another one, be self-confident. It's okay to meet a guy around the keg or the pong table, but hold out for a real date. You deserve it. Young ladies who are listening, I was a resident counselor in college as well as a guy who partied a lot. I've seen this from all the different sides. And people would say at Amherst when I was there, which now seems like it was eons ago, the dating is dead at Amherst. Well, I had a very serious girlfriend at Amherst, and we had a great time together, and I took her out on dates. She was my girlfriend. I knew her family. I knew her siblings, and I treated her with respect. I treated her as my friend, and yes, she was a romantic partner. Every single young woman listening to the show right now, I advise you to demand all of those things from somebody that you are going to be physical with. I'm not here moralizing. I'm not telling you, you know, you got to wait till marriage. I'm not preaching abstinence or any of that. I am just saying that you should demand respect and a relationship from somebody that you plan on being physically involved with. It's just going to 9 times out of 10 make you happier in the end, in my experience, which is all that I can speak from. People would say dating is dead at Amherst College. That was not true. That was a self-justifying lie that people would spread all over the place so that they could feel like their behavior was normalized. But dating was not dead. Some of us chose to actually have girlfriends and or boyfriends and go about things in a slightly more old-fashioned way. I'm not all that old-fashioned, but when it comes to these issues, there's a lot of wisdom in the older folks. And I know everyone who's listening who's, you know, 35, which is my age, and above, probably is shaking their head in agreement with most of this because they've seen it, because they know. They know. And I get it. When you're 22 and you're, you know, 19, it feels like it's all so new and exciting and you want to be liked and you want to be cool. And I understand all those pressures. But that's why a piece like this in the Wall Street Journal from a woman who is just telling it like it is so helpful. So be self-confident. Ask for a real date. Spend time with people. You can make your own decisions about how fast or how far you go, but make sure that the person is actually a person that sees you as a person. Here's another bit of advice she gives. Buyer beware. If you decide to participate in the hookup culture, go in with your eyes open. Promises made in the heat of passion are meaningless. Suitors will promise the moon to get you into bed. Many of them will want nothing to do with you the next day, which will leave you feeling humiliated and exploited. That doesn't make you a rape victim. It makes you naive. Guys will lie to get girls into bed. This is nothing new. This is not a surprise to any of you. But it's in the moment when someone's saying things and they're hearing all the right things, people forget this, especially younger people who college aged, and they just feel like this is the one, or there's so much passion here, it has to be right. Slow it down. Slow it down. Next bit of advice. Be clear about your wishes. If you do not want to do something, say so clearly. You are an adult and you have free will and moral agency. You have a right to say no at any stage, but do not expect your partner to infer reluctance from your demeanor. Only you know what makes you uncomfortable, and it's up to you to articulate it. This woman's a lawyer, and she's making very clear that the boundaries should be clear from anybody who's engaging in sexual conduct. If you're going to be doing that stuff, as a lot of people on campuses, a lot of college-age people are, if you're old enough to do that, you're old enough to speak your mind about what you're okay with and what you're not. And, you know, if you're not, comfortable doing that, then you shouldn't be with that person. This is old-fashioned advice, I know, but it's good advice. I always remember I had a grandmother who was just a wonderful, I had two grandmothers, but one grandmother on my maternal side was just a wonderful person. Really, just a great human being, very smart, very wise, very kind, and really fun to talk to, but, you know, understood that you had to enjoy life too. You know, she liked dance and music and food, and, you know, she was very religious, but she also understood that you got to have fun too. You know, there was a balance to be struck all the time. And she gave advice. I remember hearing the advice from her she had three daughters, and the advice was very simple. It was, and I think it would upset the feminists of the world right now to hear this kind of thing. Well, at least on one point, it was maintain your appearance, part one, and if he ever hits you, you leave. That's part two. Now, that's not a roadmap for everything in life, but those are two very good parts of advice. Maintain your appearance is not a superficial standpoint, by the way. If you're in a monogamous relationship with somebody, you have an obligation to the other person in that relationship to try and present yourself as best you can. This isn't everyone has to be an underwear model. This isn't no one's good enough. It's just try to be respectful of the fact that in a relationship between a man and a woman, there is also a physical bond along with the emotional, spiritual, and psychological bond. And so you do the best you can. You don't just give up, basically. Now, people would say, oh, that's, you know, that's not about that, and you have kids. And okay, fine. I'm just telling you, I think that's, from what I have seen in life, I think that is sound advice. And the other one is self-explanatory. If he hits you, you leave. Absolutely. You're gone. You're done. There's no second round. There's no part two. So I always thought that was very interesting, very straightforward advice. And I think that some young women today on college campuses would really benefit from older, wiser women telling them the truth about what really goes on between men and women and giving them real advice. And I should just note in this piece, this author finishes by saying, if you're ever assaulted, seek immediate help from someone you trust who is not affiliated with the college and go to the police. Because she says the college's interests are not the same as these young women who are in fact assaulted, and they sometimes will try to find a way to take care of their public relations interests first and foremost. So I thought this was a very powerful piece by Jennifer Braceras, and I really think young women, look, my little sister is now a fully grown law school graduate and, you know, is a woman who, you know, I go to for advice. But if she were still in college, I promise you, I would have sent her, you know, she's engaged and she's going to be getting married soon. But if she were still in college, I would send her this piece and say, Daisy, you got to read this. And I think that's how I feel about my little sister. So any young woman across the country right now, read this piece in the Journal. Buck is back with you here, team. I have something of a follow-up to yesterday when I was telling you about my memories of 9/11 and how on my college campus at Amherst, there was a sentiment among some professors and even some students that somehow we shouldn't be focusing on the massive jihadist sneak attack that killed a few thousand of our people, but that the real problem was U.S. foreign policy or even the response to the 9/11 attacks. There was, as I have mentioned before on this show, a flag burning a few weeks after the 9/11 attacks, and I was there and saw it happen. And you had the classic leftist idiots, the kinds of individuals who would be cheering on a modern-day Antifa protest, lighting flags on fire, not at some rally to support the robust U.S. foreign policy of invading foreign countries. No, it was a community session for thanking everybody for their kindness and well wishes from those who had lost family members on 9/11. And one of them was a friend of mine, a classmate of mine, who lost her sister in one of the towers. And these imbeciles showed up and lit flags on fire. Now, that was back in 2001. And I believe the Boston Globe, or maybe it was the Boston Herald, covered that story because a flag burning at a ceremony remembering the recently dead in 9/11, that got some attention. But it seems like not much has changed because just yesterday there was a banner unveiled at Amherst College above the one dining hall, Valentine Hall. And the banner said that in honor of those killed and displaced by America's so-called war on terror, and it also said that there is no flag large enough to cover the shame of killing innocent people, which people attribute as a quote to the historian Howard Zinn. So it's 9/11, and you have people on Amherst campus who are remembering what happened in what happened on that day. And there was a young woman, Marita Tam, who was killed in one of the towers, who had been a senior at Amherst when I was a freshman. And she was one of three to whom the Amherst College community was paying tribute yesterday. And these idiot students decided to hang a banner. I should also note that the students, or rather that the administrators on campus, take the position that they took back in 2001, which is, while they think it's insensitive, they'll say that, quote, free speech enables all citizens of this country to express their opinions, even if their views are expressed in a manner that might offend, end quote. Okay, I agree. So on the issue of a mass casualty terrorist attack, it seems that the Amherst College administrators have an understanding of the First Amendment, that yes, in fact, it does include the right, the ability to offend. Do they apply that principle, however, to discussions on campus about affirmative action? Do they apply that principle that, quote, free speech enables all citizens of this country to express their opinions, end quote, when it comes to racial set-asides in the admissions process, when it comes to housing on campus that is also set aside for preferred racial groups? Do they allow for the discussion then? Oh, no, my friends. I can assure you that they would, under the rubric of hate crimes or hate speech, try to shut that down. So this is a perfect example of exactly, forget about the idiot students for a second. There'll always be dumb kids on college campuses whose parents are paying too much money for them to be not educated at all. But look at the administrators, look at the adults, the overpaid college bureaucrats and how they respond. When it comes to offending the families of the dead from the Amherst community who were killed in 9/11, they just have to, they'll only talk about how it's insensitive. But if it came to a mean discussion about diversity, yeah, First Amendment doesn't apply anymore, does it? Tells us a lot. Welcome back, team. Buck Sexton here. I feel like it would be, I would be remiss if I didn't at least give you some tips that I have come up with over the years of doing radio, doing TV, and being in the midst of interviews, hostile panel discussions, all kinds of stuff. Some tips that I have found for public speaking in general. One of the big ones is, no surprise here, know what you're going to say beforehand. Very few people can just pull it out of thin air off the cuff. But you don't have to know every word, just have a sense of where you're going to go. That also means have a sense of timing. You don't want to end up, those of you who are familiar with the movie Old School, having to get bailed out by your buddy Vince Vaughn.
Right there, and it continues right here, because I think what my friend Mitch is trying to say is that true love is blind.
So you want to know what you're going to say, and you want to know how long you're going to go. Shorter is better. That is something to always keep in mind. I have never once been in a social setting in particular where somebody was making a toast or giving a speech, and I thought, wow, that was just too short. I have been in the situation many times where I've had to think to myself, well, that was quite long. I remember years ago being at a family member's wedding, and it was the rehearsal dinner for the wedding, and you had people standing up and giving toast, and it was very nice. But for whatever reason, it was a big rehearsal dinner, people started standing up to give toasts who were increasingly removed from the actual bride and groom. So you had people standing up who were saying things like, look, you know, I'm not really much of a public speaker, but I don't really know these two. But I just want to say, you know, I look back on my life and I got a lot of regrets. it was kind of like that. I mean, it was a lot of people that were giving speeches that maybe shouldn't have been giving those speeches. Another tip, and this is true for interviews. It's true. I'm giving away some of my secrets here, some of the Freedom Hut public speaking tips to become, well, whatever it is that you want to do. One thing is know the first line that you're going to say. That's the only thing that I recommend knowing word for word beforehand. So however you're going to start your speech, because I don't recommend reading. I see this at wedding after wedding. People read their speech. You want to go bullet points. Know what you're going to say beforehand for the first line, though. Welcome, everybody. I'm so glad to be here to be giving a toast for John and Sally. Right. I know it seems very straightforward, but if you know what your first line is and you focus on the delivery, you've already created a momentum in your head for everything else you're going to say. If you stand up and you go, hello, everybody. I'm here for, and you know, public speaking is one of the biggest fears that people have. I think some studies show it's like the most widely shared fear that people have. Know your first line. Practice your first line. Say it out loud. For an important speech, an important toast, any of the above, give yourself the ability to practice beforehand if you can. Now, that's not always possible, But if you have the opportunity, that doesn't mean sit there and read it to yourself. It doesn't mean, it means stand up in front of a mirror and do it. Give the speech. Do it more than once. But no matter what, remember, shorter is better. Know what you're going to say before you start speaking, meaning know the major points, and have your first line cold. Your first line should be something that you could say in your sleep. You could say after 10 shots of tequila. You could get that first line out no matter what. Interviews, toasts, anything. You name it. For a big speech in front of your whole class. First line, have it down. No guesses. Don't deviate. No ifs, ands, or buts. All right, those are my thoughts on that one. I want to ask you to please download the podcast, as always. Buck Sexton with America Now on iTunes, and you can check out all of our latest gear at bucksexton.com/store. We also post stories throughout the day on bucksexton.com. I've got a piece up on the Hill looking at whether we would, under any circumstances, consider using nuclear weapons against North Korea. It's a philosophical international relations piece up on thehill.com that I would recommend to you all. So please do check that out too. It's also on facebook.com/bucksexton. Thanks, as always, for hanging out. Until next time, team.
The Tunnel to Towers Foundation has been helping America's heroes and their families since 9/11. Hero first responders and service members who serve our communities and our country. Those who die in the line of duty or are catastrophically injured. Veterans who fought for our nation's freedom only to return home, fall on tough times, and become homeless. Heroes like Buffalo, New York firefighter Jason Arno and his family. Arno was killed while protecting his community, battling a warehouse fire. He left behind his wife and a young daughter. In their darkest hour, Tunnel to Towers provided Arno's wife and daughter with a mortgage-free home. The foundation lifted a financial burden, enabling them to stay in the home where they made memories with their hero. Join Tunnel to Towers on its mission to do good. Support the families of America's greatest heroes, the families of fallen first responders like Jason Arno, plus Gold Star families with young children, catastrophically injured service members, and homeless veterans. Donate $11 a month at T2T.org. That's T, the number 2T.org.
From original art and diplomas to ticket stubs and the keys to your first home, we all have mementos we'd love to put on display. Framebridge is the easy and affordable way to custom frame just about anything, with fair upfront pricing based on the size of your item and fast, free shipping. Plus, your happiness is guaranteed. See why Framebridge has been trusted to frame over 2 million pieces. Visit Framebridge.com or a local Framebridge store to get started. That's Framebridge.com.
So I know you've got a lot going on, but remember, I'm here for you. So bother me when no one's listening, because I will. Bother me when it feels like it won't get better, because it can. Bother me because you're never a bother. Whether it's a low point or a crisis, get help for yourself or a friend. Learn more at neverabother.org or call or text 988, available 24/7.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.